Okay. Okay, let's move on. This has been, as usual, a bit slow. So we talked about input tasks, selection tasks. Now the next one I want to talk about is trigger tasks. It's an easier category. Trigger task is when you trigger, trigger an action. So the most well-known way to trigger tasks is to use buttons. But a lot of menus are, in fact, menus of commands, where each command is an action. So again, you're selecting among a set of existing actions, using a selection task to actually do a trigger task, which is to launch the command that is listed in the menu. Two other common categories of trigger tasks on graphical user interfaces: drag and drop. So drag and drop is you take an object that is draggable and you move it and drop it on what's called usually a drop area. And the advantage of this technique is that the resulting action can depend on both the objects you're dragging and where you're dropping it. Yes?
Yep.
So there is this kind of combinatorial explosion that means that with n types of objects, you can have n square possibilities. The downside of drag and drop is that it's not always obvious what is draggable and where you can drop things. Right? So it's not what we call discoverable, where if you don't know, and if you don't have the idea of even try to drag something, you will miss the feature. As you're dragging an object, usually if you're over a drop area, the drop area should highlight to tell you, well, you can drop it here, which will also give you an idea of what's going to happen. But for example, when you drag an object, normally there's no easy way to figure out what are all the drop areas on the screen, which would help in making things a bit more discoverable. The last technique for triggering actions is gestural input, which is not used very often on mouse-based interfaces, because with the mouse, we're not very good at controlling precise motion. So, because when you move the mouse, you do it essentially with your wrist. Whereas if you do something precise, you're doing it with the tip of your fingers, like writing. Nevertheless, that's of course, gesture input is a lot more heavily used on touch-based interfaces, but also in some mouse-based interfaces. So the idea with the gestural input is that you're using the trace or the ink left by the trajectory of the mouse. Remember that inking was one of the basic techniques at the beginning. So you use the ink, and unlike drag and drop, where you only look at where you started or where you dropped, here you analyze all the trajectory of that ink, and you make a decision on what the gesture that the trace represents. And you can have gestures that are literal representations of the objects you are creating, so it can be used for input tasks, as we saw earlier. So here I draw this coarse rectangle, and the system will create a rectangle with more or less that size. I can use it for selection. So here I'm circling a set of objects, and the system will figure out what is inside that selection. So it's lassoing. So that's gestural input used for a selection task. It can be used here for a trigger task, for more like a drag and drop in that case, where I can tap inside an object and move it directly. Or maybe if I end the move with a little C here, it means I want to make a copy instead of moving the object. So here we're seeing a gesture that combines a position information. I want this object and I want to put it there. together with what I would call command information or semantic information, I want to do a copy instead of a move. Then you are what you have what we call more iconic gestures, gestures that represent, that evoke something. So if I scribble over an object, maybe the system will interpret it as I want to erase it, to delete it, like I would do with an eraser. So that is a kind of gestural icon to say delete. In another example here of editing musical score, I can interpret the gestures as the notes on a staff, where I know where the note is on the staff, and depending on the tail here, what type of note it is, which is a lot more efficient than if I had to select a note in a type of note in the palette and then move it into the staff. Here I can just draw like I would do on paper. What I don't show here is that then this gets turned into proper, nice typeset notes, not just this squiggles. Here's the last example of using gestures for triggering actions, where I have a spreadsheet, and some simple actions like inserting a column can be done with a little V in between those two columns. If I want to calculate the sum of a column, I will use a swiping gesture to go over the cells I want to select, and I draw this little sigma at the end, and the system will understand that as a shortcut for calculating the sum of the items I mark. So gestural input, again, advantage and issues. Advantage, it's very efficient. It's fast. Is it intuitive or not intuitive? So discoverability, to me, discoverability is a little bit different from intuitive, and that was my next point. Gestures are not discoverable. There's nothing. You get to a fully gestural interface, you don't know what to do, right? The only thing, you can try things if you're experimental. What about if you know that there's gestures involved, how likely are you to use this the right gestures? Right.
By selecting, by serving something that is natural to me, but I wouldn't necessarily think of trying like a sigma sign.
Right. Yeah. So that's really what has been a problem with, in particular, touch interfaces that rely on gesture input a lot more so than traditional graphical user interfaces. And if you think, and I get back to what I was saying before the break, when you interact with your smartphone, what is the vocabulary of gestures you're using? What gestures are you doing when you use your smartphone? So tap, swipe, pinch. So that would be the pinch out, pinch in. Yeah, that's it. So in a sense, it's even more poor than the mouse interface, because on the mouse you have the click, you have the double click, and then all the modifiers, which gives you, out of the box, more options than just touch, swipe, pinch. At the same time, the strength of, again, the iPhone, which has been copied by everybody else, has been to be able to create a fairly efficient and powerful interface based on only these gestures. Now, there are systems I know, especially on Android, where you can create your own gestures as shortcuts. Does anybody know that?
Yeah.
Yes?
Even on iPhone.
Yes, too. But, yeah, it started on the Android, I think. And so what do you use it for? I mean, what's... So you know it exists, but you don't use it?
Yeah.
Okay, and why?
I don't know what to create.
Okay, you don't know what to... Okay. So nobody else uses gesture shortcuts?
There's actually a 3D gesture where you can not my phone to take a screenshot.
Okay.
Now my phone with two fingers to take a screen recording, and with his finger.
The knuckles.
Knuckles, yeah. You use like a net, and it can take a long screenshot.
Okay. Wow. Who knew that? Discoverability, yes. Okay, so you knew as well. Okay, so that's really a big problem. So how would we make things more discoverable for end users? So this is work we did in the group. And you see it's 10 years old. And in a sense, I could say it was inspired by the marking menus. This idea that when the user doesn't know what to do, you hesitate. So you're starting something and then you pause. And we can take that as a signal that this user needs help. So in the marking menu, if you do the gesture quickly, the menu doesn't show up and you do your thing and if you did the right command, it goes on. If you don't know what to do, you pause, and within 333 milliseconds, third of a second in the original paper, the menu appears. And that's short enough that if you're a novice, you won't really notice because you are thinking at the same time as the system is waiting for the pause. And if you're an expert, but suddenly you don't remember something, you know that you can pause and it's going to not slow you down too much. So what we did for gesture was to say, well, if you put your finger down or your pen down and you do nothing, then we'll show you the gestures that are available in that particular context. And if you know what you're doing, then you do it quickly and it will work. So this is a video of the system called Octopus. So it's a dynamic guide with feed forward and feedback. So here I want to do the help command, and it's up there, and it shows me to follow the orange trail. Now you notice that as I was following this trail, the other possibilities disappeared because they became unlikely or impossible to draw from what I had already drawn. So in novice mode, I follow the path. In intermediate, I can start and then pause, and it shows me what is left to do. And in expert mode, I just do the gesture, and there's no feedback, and it just flashes the command. Here I'm going to do it for a save, so I go towards S, and you see that the other path, because they have different directions, disappear, and I don't have this cluttered screen. So we showed with this interface that people could learn these gestures. In fact, we use it with this type of vocabulary, like question mark for help, an S for save. So here we have things where the beginning is very similar, but then later on they distinguish from each other, and to show how this works in practice. And so we showed that it helped people learn these gestures. We went, up to 12 or 16. We also used it with the gesture you would do in the marking menu, just having the eight directions at two levels corresponding to the possibilities of a marking menu. So the point here is this is the marking menu, I think. The point here is that you can bridge the gap between a technique that is that seems to be by nature not discoverable, like gesture input, by providing a dynamic guide. What we call feed forward is tell you what is possible. So if you hesitate, it should give you feed forward to tell you, well, now you can do this or that. And it's giving you feedback about what it has recognized so far. And it's this feed forward feedback that works together to help people discover and learn the gestures. And then once you've done that, there is the natural transition to doing it faster and faster if you know the gesture and the system does not get in the way. We use similar techniques for learning multi-touch gestures, what we call chords, where you put several fingers down at the same time. And depending on the configuration of the fingers, it can mean different things. And again, we showed that with this dynamic guide, we can help people learn these more advanced types of gestures. Now, there, you know, we could say a lot about gesture input. I think there is an elective that focuses on that. So this is just scratching the surface. So we move on to navigation task. So navigation is the idea that the content on the screen is larger than the screen or the window, so you need ways to access to content that is not currently visible. Now we all know, of course, the scroll bar as the main means of navigating on screen, although on touch devices, direct scrolling has been taking over the scroll bars. And direct scrolling, in fact, was, I think, pioneered in a commercial product by the Adobe PDF Viewer, where you had this little hand and you could move the text with the... Now, problems with scroll bars is that they create a division of attention, because you need to look at the scroll bar to click on the thumb, the little thing you can move, or on the arrows, which are usually pretty small. And in particular, when you scroll through with the thumb, if you then focus on the document, which is what you want to look at to know where you're going, your cursor is going to get away and away from the scroll bar itself, because you're not paying attention. And on some interfaces, if you are too far away, the system decides, oh, you don't want to scroll anymore. So there is this division of attention that is not always well taken into account. The other thing is there is something very strange for some people, that you have to move the thumb towards the top, so you have to move it upwards for the document to move downwards. Yes, you had noticed that? Now, it becomes really interesting when you have this mouse-based interaction versus direct scrolling, where if I want to get to the top of document, I have to move it down, because I'm directly interacting with the document. And then you can also scroll with the mouse wheel, if you have a mouse wheel. And then the question is, which direction should the document go if I scroll the wheel, say, upwards, which is not even upwards because I have another direction, which is my surface is horizontal and the screen is vertical, which is a problem for some people to do the mapping. Okay, so if I move the wheel of the mouse wheel away from me, is the document going down? Who says it's going down? Who says it's going up?
It depends not on how you set your...
It depends. Okay, so we have some it depends. It goes down. Anybody says it's going up? It's going up. Do you know what you're doing when you're using it, or do you have to figure it out each time?
I always figure it out.
Yeah, you always figure it out. I see some confused faces. It's like suddenly I have created it.
Same mouse to your Mac system or to your Windows system.
Yeah. So this sort of scrolling is interesting, because the scroll bar is not an object we have transferred from the real world into the digital world. I mean, have you ever seen it? You buy a scroll bar, in a drugstore or in a hardware store? No. We find other ways to deal with like pages and books. We don't scroll books in the physical. people as well. So it's an invention. Another invention has been the scroll wheel, because the adding, I think it's one of the rare cases in the first 20, 30 years of HCI and commercial products, that there was a major hardware change, where the typical mouse, which had 1, 2, 3, 4, 10 buttons, suddenly had this new device, the scroll wheel. And the scroll wheel was really a shortcut to move that thing. So if you push it away from you, the thing would go up, and when the thing goes up, the document goes down. And then touchpads came into the picture. So a lot of people were using a mouse, but also a touchpad on their laptop. And on the touchpad, the idea was that there was a shortcut to the scroll wheel, if you wish, which was two finger scrolling. And so since you push up for the thumb to go up and the document to go down, on the scroll, on the touchpad, you would put your two fingers up, like on the scroll wheel, for the document to go down. And then smartphones arrived. And on the smartphone, the direct scrolling took over. Part of the reason was that direct scrolling works when you can do this directly on the document if the document is not editable, because there's no conflict between using the mouse for scrolling versus using the mouse for selecting, right? So in direct scrolling, yes? Yes, because you can scroll only at the speed. The original direct scrolling did not have inertial scrolling, where you throw the thing up. You had to. That is true as well. But the thing with direct scrolling is, for the document to go up, you push up. And when people started to have smartphones in their pocket and laptops in their desks, they were scrolling one direction, indirect scrolling on their smartphone, and doing the same gesture on their trackpad or touchpad did the opposite thing. Confusing. So Apple, this time, made a radical decision, which annoyed a lot of people, including me, which was to say, well, we'll make this consistent, and on the touchpad and on the mouse wheel, now, you know, you're not controlling the thumb, you're controlling the document. And in fact, they went as far as removing the scroll bar from the display if you don't have a mouse attached. And the scroll bar only shows up while you're scrolling the document to show you where you are. And at first I was annoyed. Like, yeah, I understand the reasoning and why it's consistent, but I was getting wrong all the time. And then I tried longer, and now when I go to a machine where someone has put the other setting, or I don't know what the state of Windows is these days, I get very confused. And that's the case where you need to change your mental model. With scroll bars, we learn that the scroll bar is a representation of the document, and the little thumb is the keyhole. I move up and down the document to see the part of the document, and I forget about the document itself. So we have learned this indirection introduced by the scroll bar, indirection that creates this inversion of the control, in a sense. But if you take the time to unlearn this thing, the fact that you have something consistent between the direct scrolling you can do on smartphone or on your bigger display, and scrolling the scroll wheel and scrolling on the touchpad, that all seems consistent and natural. And so my point here is, what we consider natural is a result of what we've learned and what we've practiced. There's not, and so there's no such thing as something more natural than something else. I hate this word because it's misleading. We learn things, if they are more consistent, they tend to feel more natural, but we learn things that are inconsistent and that at some point feel also more natural because we've learned them. Yes?
Why not the importance?
Well, but I think the solution that Apple has arrived to is doing this synthesis, because now the consistency is that you focus on the document, so you can do direct scrolling up or indirect scrolling with the mouse wheel or the two-finger scrolling, all the same direction are consistent. Now, if you want, you can take your mouse, move it to the side of the document, the scroll bar happen, and there you scroll the scroll bar the good old way. But that's become more the exception than the rule in a sense.
You can also change them on and off, all the scroll bar, you can switch words back to the old
yeah.
way.
Yeah. But there's a point that was made there by your colleague that direct scrolling is slow. And even though now we have inertial scrolling where you throw the thing, and at least on Apple devices, if you scroll three times in the same direction, it actually accelerates, which I find annoying because you can never decelerate unless you stop completely. But still, sometimes you find yourself, you know, scrolling and scrolling, whereas a scroll bar, no matter the size of the document, it's mapped to a fixed size on the screen, so it can be very fast. Yes? Well, and that's a good point. I mean, the scrolling works in two dimensions, which I didn't talk about here. And the horizontal scrolling with a regular scroll wheel is going to be hard. Apple decided to put either a little ball, like a mini track ball, which doesn't wear out very well, or on the what they call the Magic Mouse, it's a touch surface that. It's like a trackpad. But there's also some wheels that detect when you push left and right and do more automatic scrolling. One thing that was for a while to minimize the direct scrolling actions was that if you scroll and you reach the top, it starts auto-scrolling. That was the worst. Because suddenly, you know, the thing starts going just at the moment where you were reaching your target. And you have the sense of losing control, which is really really annoying. Okay, so again, devil is in the detail to make these things work in ways that people will feel, quote, natural. The last thing I want to talk about is another thing that's become now very common, especially with Google Maps, is the idea that, you know, when you have very large content, you can zoom in and out. In addition to scrolling. In that context, we talked about pan and zoom, panning and zooming rather than scrolling and zooming for historical reasons. Pan and zoom comes from the world of cinematography, panoramic. And you all know that. So you can zoom out to get an overview, and you can zoom in to get detail. Although here, too, there are some interesting mapping issues. Now, if you are on the touch interface, you know, the zoom in and out is going to be pinch in and pinch out because it's direct mapping, you're stretching or you're... But something that drives me personally absolutely crazy with Google Maps is the way they map the direction of when you scroll, whether, again, pushing, should it zoom in or zoom out? Zoom in? Everybody's for zoom in? Yeah? Okay. I don't know, I must be weird. I always get it wrong. So I don't know what it is, but I always get it wrong. And that's a case where it is arbitrary. I mean, there's no, you know, before you could make an argument looking at a scroll bar or looking at a document, when you're mapping this 1D gesture to zooming in or out, there's no reason really to do the mapping one way or the other. We'll talk next time, I guess, because I'm going really slow, about zoomable interfaces, because there's a number of interesting results from, I would say, theoretical HCI on it, and it's also a subject I've studied quite a bit. But let's move on so we finish covering this. Next category is what I call property and parameter specification. Now we talked about, this should really go next to trigger tasks. When you trigger a task with a button or with a menu item, sometimes, oftentimes, there's not enough information for the system to perform the task. So if you want to print the document, the system is going to need to know what printer you're printing to, how many copies, etc. So in many cases, the command needs additional parameters to be specified. And we enter the world of dialog boxes. So the solution that has been found has been to say, well, when you have a command that needs additional information, it's going to pop up a dialog box that the user will fill out. And it's when the user clicks OK that the command is actually executed. Now, the question is, OK, what we're doing here is creating what's called a mode. Because while the dialog box is up, the system is waiting for this information, which raises the question of, are you only allowed to interact with this box until you click OK? This is called a modal dialog box. It's typically the case if you bring the dialog box to save your document to a file. You have the box. Until you click OK or cancel, you can do nothing else. Now there's two types of modal dialog boxes. There's the application modal, which means you can still switch to another application to do something else and then get back to this one. And there is the system modal where everything else is blocked. Now, mark my words, modal dialogues should not exist. Modal dialogues are a facility for developers to make their lives easier because they don't have to think of, oh God, what could happen while this dialog box is up, and what if, you know, if I have the file save dialog up and I can do something else, what if I can bring a second file save dialog, what's going to happen? And it raises all sorts of issues. So, too complicated, we'll make it easy for us and constrain the user to do the thing in the order we have decided.
Would you say this apply unconditionally? Because what, for instance, you like in your log application, you create a new document, another document,
yep.
You like your file view, something like this, and then you can edit lots of parameters, or at least a few parameters, which are maybe required to define which type of document you want to create. But in a way, you open this sort of...
But I think there's always the question of, why do I have to do that? Why, when I create a Photoshop document, do I have to select the size as a first step? I think, I'm sure there are exceptions, and there will be exceptions typically when you're dealing with a system connected to things in the physical world where you have physical constraints. But if you think about it, 99% of the time, there's no reason for a dialog box to be modal. The only time is if you really want to warn the user that what is about to do is really not undoable or is going to have, you know, big side effects or something, and you really want to make... But that should not be a box where you have a bunch of things to fill out before you say, okay, it should be an alert box saying, are you sure? And are you sure you're sure? So, yeah, I can accept exceptions for that. But in general, there is really no good reason. And in fact, if you see the evolution of interfaces, there's been a move to using inspectors instead of dialog box. In fact, in the original Xerox Star interface, the interface had property boxes. It did not have dialog boxes in the way we just described, that forces you to do an OK before you trigger. It had this property sheets they were called, and the Xerox Star. And the idea here is that instead of having a box that tells you, well, what is the size of the, this is a made-up example, what is the size of text, and then click OK, well, I select the object, and I have an inspector for that object that shows me the properties of that object that I can manipulate. Here, if I move the slider, the object will resize, so I can see exactly what I'm doing. And there is no OK at the end. I'm just acting directly on the object. And this way, I have a more direct manipulation. At least I have incremental change of whose effect is immediately visible. And I don't have it's not forcing me to this pass through the data box. More and more interfaces are doing this, which is a good thing. And as I say, this was the case on the original Xerox Star. This was the property sheet for text, where you have all these things, and at any point of time, you can select anything in there, and it will affect the text that is selected. Getting back to the dialog boxes here, the other problem with dialog boxes is that it's seen as, again, a way for designers to not design. By saying we're going to throw every, you know, feature, setting, whatever we can think of in those dialog boxes, and then we'll let the users figure them out. I mean, if you look to the dialog box to set the properties of a paragraph in Word, I think I counted a while back, and I had found over 100 of them. So what happens is the dialog box became more and more complicated. So people say, why are we going to put optional parts? So you've probably seen this thing where the dialog box is, looks small, but in fact there's this button, you turn it on, and then you see a bunch more things. Or, and that's the worst, putting tabs in dialog boxes. That's really takes the cake in terms of unusability. Because you have to browse through tabs, and there is an OK button here, and it's like, OK, what is the OK button doing, by the way? If I have changed things in another tab, is it going to OK those things I did in this other tab or not? This is really bad design at its best. Optional parts, I can understand, and again, there's this notion of transitioning from novice to expert. At least if you do this, it means you have thought about, okay, what is really the critical settings for that particular command, or parameters, what are the critical parameters, and what are the things that we expect only expert users to use. And that's, I think, you know, if you don't have another choice, acceptable solution, which you can find in inspectors as well. You can have inspectors with parts that reveal more parameters. But yeah, at least you have had to make the decision of what is important and what is only for experts. And if you do that, the very important thing to do is to remember in what state the user left it. Because an expert does not want every single time it opens its thing to have to reopen the expert part because that's the one he uses all the time. So if you do this, this is actually a setting that has to be remembered across successive uses. Okay, dialog boxes. I think, I don't know if I convinced you, but. Yes?
I have one point about dialog boxes. Boxes are useful for certain cases. Like, I think in safety critical settings, it makes sense to guide a user who is just like workbook or perhaps in like an installation of a new program. It's good for guiding the user by step by step flow.
So, guiding the user. To me, that's a different thing than what I'm talking about here, because having a step-by-step procedure for a critical task or for a learning process is something you can design as such. But if there is no alternative to do it more directly, once you know the procedure, or if you know the procedure, I think it is a problem. With safety critical system, the problem you have, there's a whole area around how do you warn users about dangerous things, right? We all know this thing that, you know, you save or you want to do a command and it says, are you sure, because it's not undoable. And you see it all the time and you click yes all the time. And the one time where you didn't want to do the thing, you realize after I didn't click the confirmation box. We've all seen that. So again, it's a question of we learn some patterns, and it's not going to be effective on the one time where you need it. So I think guiding people through steps does not require a model interface. And yes, in safety critical situations, you may want to design things differently. I absolutely agree with that. That's why I was saying when you deal with systems that impact the physical world, it can be a bit different. But the fact, for example, for many years, you would have to save your document not lose it in case of a crash. Now, pretty much everything is saved as you go, so this is not so much an issue. But for many, many years, you had to save the document. To save the document, you had to give it a name. And sometimes I don't know the name yet I want to give it. I don't know where I want to put it in my file system. But I also know that I need to do the save if I don't want to lose the file in case of a crash. And so that's something when we talk about the theoretical models in HCI, something called premature commitment. Asking the user to do something at the point in time where he's not ready to do it. But again, I think that's a slightly different issue of having a model interface that blocks everything else. Blocking everything else, if you do it, you really have to have a good reason for doing it, and that is not, it's more convenient for the programmer. Because I think a lot of data boxes that are modeled because of the comfort of the programmer. I convince you? Okay. Last type of task, transformation tasks. So in a sense, this is a case where you can set parameters of a command in a direct way, because that command and that parameter is expressed visually in a graphical representation. So if I have this rectangle and I want to give it a new size, I want to be able to drag it so it gets the size that I want. Now, if I'm in a CAD system, I maybe also want to have an inspector, more than the dialog box, where I can type numbers or see the exact numbers, because if I have to create a table of a certain size, I know the size and I want to be able to type it in. But in many cases, when you do this kind of manipulations, it's the visual aspect that counts. And so typically the technique that has been used to for direct manipulation of these objects is to have handles on them. So it tells you what are the parts that are movable and editable. So here it's the 8 handles around rectangular object. Here it's a polyline, so you can move each of the line. And here is a more complex object that has that's a curve, so it has tangents. And here I want to be able to move the control points themselves, but also change by clicking on the little dots here, change the tangent at this point. And so there are many cases where you can turn a set, particularly of numerical parameters, into a visual representation to make it, again, a more direct manipulation interface. It's not valid for everything, of course, by far, but we are visual. We're driven by our visual sense, so things that can be done visually are going to be more effective than things can be done only through text input. Even though, again, sometimes you know the numbers, you want to enter the numbers, and that should be possible. So now we've seen the basic vocabulary in the sense of pointing, selection, and dragging. We've seen this basic interaction tasks with all the little interaction techniques, the menus, the property boxes, all these things, which provide us with the vocabulary in the sense of graphical interaction. Now there's a question of how we assemble these techniques together to build an interface. And that brings up the notion of a mode. So I already mentioned modes in modal dialog box, with the idea that when the dialog box is up, well, you constrain the user to a subset of the actions. More generally, I would describe a mode as the state of the interface where the user actions, clicking, dragging, touching, are interpreted in a way that is consistent within that mode, but different from the way they're interpreted in different modes. So the key thing here is that if I am in mode A, a certain action will have a certain effect. If I'm in mode B, the same action will have a different effect. So it's all a question of mapping from actions to action to reaction from the system. And in different modes, the same actions have different effects. Now, this is something that is confusing because in the real world, we're not used to the same action having different effects if we operate on the same object. So you'll find a lot of literature that says modes are bad, modes are terrible, you should have interfaces without modes. I'm sorry to say, except for the most simplest interface, it's just impossible. Larry Tesler is the guy who invented cut, copy, paste, which, yes, had to be invented. And it took him a lot of time to convince his colleagues that this was a good idea. He is well known for being an adversary of modes and fighting against modes. In fact, he has a car whose license plate reads no modes. So he's really into it. But I think that the issue, and I respect Larry Tesler, but I think we don't use the word mode in the same way. And modes can certainly be used badly. And a typical example is modes in text editing. So who here uses VI or Vim? Don't be ashamed.
All the time?
No, who knows it? Okay, so you know it. Who, is anybody knows Emacs anymore? Oh yeah, good. Okay, so to me, these two systems have modes. The one is bad and one is good. Now, in the VI type of family of editors, you have to hit the escape key to switch mode. And there's essentially a mode where if I type the letter D, it puts the letter D in my text. And there's another mode where if I type the letter D, it deletes the character under the cursor. Which has kind of two radically different things for the same action. Now, why is it a bad design? Because I need to keep in my head which mode I'm in. I need to remember if I hit the escape key or not. If I get up to a computer running this thing, I cannot tell what happens if I hit the letter E. Now, one option which modern versions of VI do is they show you the mode in the corner of the screen. But still, you still have, in the course of editing, you're not going to keep your eye in that corner all the time. You keep it in your head. Now compare that with the Emacs type of editing, where to insert the letter D, I type the letter D. To delete the letter at the cursor, I depress the control key, and I type the same letter D. It's very small difference. The only difference is that instead of having typed the escape key and released it, I have to maintain the control key down while I type B. But that means that it's the mental model built out of that is radically different. It's like, to me, control D is an action in itself. It's my muscles are going to learn it, in a sense. It's going to be more of a reflex. But on the face of it, once the key control is down, I'm in a different mode. And someone else could come in and push the letter D. Right? So to me, it's exactly the same definition of a mode, that the same action will have a different effect. We are in different states of the interface. In one case, to switch state, you hit and release the escape key. In the other case, to switch state or to switch mode, you depress or release the control key. Now, if you think of graphical user interfaces, there's a lot of interfaces that are based on the tool palette, where you activate the tool. Now, in a sense, activating a tool, it's like having as many escape keys as you have modes in your interface, right? Because you can have the one that lets you select objects, the one that lets you move them, the one that lets you create objects, or create lines, or create text. So all these tools are modes, exactly like the escape key. And yeah, this is a dominant type of interaction. But I think there is a difference here, which is that when you hit a tool in the palette, it feels like you are grabbing that tool, that you're holding the tool in your hand. And of course, if I have a pencil in my head or if I have an eraser, the same gesture is going to have different effects. So we are used to this tool-based interaction. Whereas in text editing, well, escape, I mean, who came up with a key called escape? Escape from what? So, you know, this notion that I'm inserting characters versus editing, it doesn't have the same strength than the analogy with using a tool to move objects or using a tool to create things. And that would be the basis for instrumental interaction, which I'll talk about next week. So my view of modes, and I say my view because there's a lot of literature around modes, and I don't think as a community we have come up with a synthesized and consistent view of this. But my view of modes is that a lot of people talk about modes that are activated at the time and deactivated later on. And these are what I call temporal modes. The ones we saw are temporal. Now, within these modes, there is what a lot of people call quasi-modes, which I just don't like because they are not quasi, they are real modes, but there are modes that are activated as long as you have a physical action. Getting the control key down. Sometimes it can be having two fingers down, etc. So all of these are, I would say, the classic modes. You enable them at some point, and you disable them or you switch to another mode at some other point. A big problem with these things is who gets to change the mode. And if I get back to the tool palette from the previous screen here, in the tool palette, you probably have noticed that if you select this tool here to create rectangles, and you create the rectangles, what happens? Can you create multiple rectangles in a row? Yes? Well, we must not be using the same tools then. Because in the majority of interfaces, after you created an object like this, it reverts to the selection tool. And the reason is because they've observed that people, after they draw a rectangle, they want to move it because they never get it right the first time. And so if it stayed with the rectangle tool or mode, you create your big rectangle, you say, oh, I want to move it, and then you create this tiny rectangle instead of actually moving the one you just created. So they figured out, well, we'll revert to the selection mode automatically after you create one object. And the more advanced interfaces have this mode within a mode where if you double-click the rectangle, then it's going to be a sticky tool that allows you to create as many rectangles as you want, and you have to switch manually. But if you do a single click, it will revert, which is not discoverable, it's confusing, and adds to the difficulty. Now, I would argue that nobody talks about another type of modes, which are the spatial mode. And the spatial mode is something we use without thinking. Again, what are the actions we're doing in this type of interface? We are doing clicks and drags. And yes, if I click on an item in the menu, it's going to do something different than if I click on inside the text to move the cursor. It's going to be different if I click in the scroll bar to move to a different position. So in a sense, every area of the screen can have a different mode. The same action may have a different effect. And you can trade time for space. That's the beauty of computer science in general. You can trade time for space. Do you know this? No. Anyway, this is another discussion. So I can use tool palettes on the screen that show me that allow me to switch mode that then change the way the rest of the screen works. But I have other ways of combining the spatial modes and the temporal modes. We'll see next time. The something called tool palettes that is a floating palette that I can move with one hand and I can click through with the other. And here, in a sense, there is no notion of mode as I describe it, a temporal mode. I don't need to switch tool to say now I'm doing this and now I'm doing that. I bring the tool palette, and as I click, I select both the tool and the object I'm acting on. So my point here is that you are used to using interfaces that have been built according to certain rules, habits, and are very stereotyped. And there is a much larger design space for doing things differently, not just for the sake of doing them differently, but doing them in a way that works better for the users. Which, of course, can only be done if you know your users, because you're not going to design a word processing system the same for someone who's writing novels, or someone who's doing memos, or someone who's doing technical documents. But nowadays, we've come to this stage where we have these massively big applications that are supposed to work the same for all different kinds of users. And that's something that I find really strange, because software is cheap. So you can buy any of 10,000 different types of cars, but you can buy pretty much one word processor today. And I don't want to say it should be the opposite, but there's certainly room for having different types of word processors or for the processing tool or you name it, catering to different types of users with interaction techniques that are tailored to those users because they have different needs and they certainly don't need to be bombarded by all the features of the world when we know that they only will use 5%. So to conclude, because I see some people sort of like to wiggle out of the room here, rightfully so, to conclude, things to remember critically: direct versus indirect manipulation. Know the principles of direct manipulation, but also know how to recognize indirect manipulation where it is needed. In the TAs, I think you will analyze and deconstruct interfaces in terms of all the building blocks we've seen today. And I think that's an exercise you can do by yourself also, or think about when you're struggling with a piece of software, or when you're enjoying a piece of software, to understand why this thing works for you and this one doesn't, in terms of these basic things. There are more things to usability in general, but I think this is a very useful approach to start with. Modes organize the structure of an interface. An interface is a clever combination of modes. So we cannot do without modes, except for the simplest of applications. Well, I guess that's it. The TA will put that into practice. And so with that, I'll conclude. Is there any question? So tomorrow you'll get the TAs. I'll see you next week, and we get back to the often have format between lectures and TAs. Okay? Thank you.